Let's begin reading at verse 5 of chapter 15. Paul has just presented in these first four verses the fact that he'd come to Corinth and he had preached to them the gospel of Christ, and that he had, in a literal sense, hand-delivered a message to them from Almighty God. And this message of salvation that they heard and they believed was that Christ suffered according to the Scriptures, died according to the Scriptures, was buried, and rose again according to the Scriptures. Now in verse 5, "And that he was seen of Cephas, then of the 12. After that he was seen of above 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain unto this present, but some are fallen asleep. After that he was seen of James, then of all the apostles. And last of all he was seen of me, also as of one born out of due time. For I am the least of the apostles, that I am not meet to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God I am what I am, and his grace which was bestowed upon me was not in vain. But I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God which was with me. Therefore, whether it were I or they, so we preach, and so ye believed." When we read the Old Testament, and we read the law, that is the spiritual and civil law that governed the nation of Israel, there were crimes that were punishable by death. The nation of Israel was a nation under the direction of God that was to practice capital punishment. In order for someone to be put to death, what they were accused of had to be established. Now, in our day and age, we might think that this was an extremely elaborate situation. That is, 12 people here, all sorts of evidence, juries, appeals. But when you read the Bible, you'll find that a person was put to death in the mouth, or that is, with the testimony of two or three witnesses. Were all the testimony that was necessary when it was a witness who had seen the crime committed. Two or three of these people, that was all that was necessary in order to establish something so definite that a person could be put to death. I want you to see in this procedure that God Himself set forth the power of an eyewitness. If two people see a crime and they corroborate one another's testimony, they are men or women who are believable, then that person's life could have been taken from him or her by the witness of two or three people. That's a lot of confidence to put in the witness, the eyewitness or the testimony, the knowledge of two people concerning a particular crime. In the field of criminal law today, an eyewitness is of great value. And there are many things that are substantiated by two or three witnesses. And when we come to the doctrine of the resurrection of Christ, we find that it is attested to not by two or three witnesses, but above 500. 500 people that Paul mentions were eyewitness to the resurrection of the Son of God. Now, if two or three witnesses are sufficient to take the life from a person, then 500 witnesses ought to be sufficient to establish a fact that has been prophesied in the Word of God. When you consider the character of these people, the apostles were eyewitnesses to the resurrection of the Son of God. And the apostles were men whose honesty and whose integrity has been unquestioned, men whose writings and whose lives have been one of the greatest blessings to the world and to the society of the world that this world has ever known. When Paul mentions in verse 4 that he was buried and that he rose again the third day, he says, and that he was seen of Cephas. When we read the writings of Peter, we understand that Peter also says that he was a witness to the resurrection of the Son of God. When we read the Gospels, we understand that Jesus instructed the women who came to the grave to specifically attend to delivering a message from him. Go and tell the disciples and Peter. Go tell people that I have risen from the grave. And I'm not really sure, but I think there was a reason for Paul mentioning Cephas or Peter. Because there had been a great deal of argument in the church, evidently about Paul and about Peter and about Apollos, at least concerning their work, their preaching, their teaching, their being men of God. There had been at least some controversy about Paul and about Peter and about Apollos, but in this statement, Paul sets aside, or at least attempts to set aside, any of the personalities that may have been involved in their service to God, and Paul says he was seen of Cephas. It might have been very human for Paul not to have mentioned the fact that Peter was an eyewitness to the resurrection of the Son of God and just included him in the 12, but this is not like Paul to take advantage of a situation. And so he immediately mentions Simon Peter. And then he was seen of the 12. And as we again look into the Word of God, you will see that this incident is recorded in the Gospels. John 20, 19 through 20 speaks of the 12 and their seeing Jesus Christ. And after that, he was seen of above 500 persons. Who were these 500 persons? I do not know. I do not know the incident. I do not know the circumstances. It is not mentioned. That is, if this was a circumstance where 500 brethren came and saw the resurrected Son of God, we have no such record in the Gospels. We have no such record in the church epistles. We have no such record in the prophetic letters such as the book of Revelation or the pastoral letters. We simply are not aware, according to some specific incident, of a time when 500 brethren gathered together saw Jesus in his post-resurrection form. However, it happened. It may include the numbers of those people who, after the resurrection of Jesus and during the time between his resurrection and his ascension into heaven in the first chapter of the book of Acts, in this period of days, that during this period of time, at least 500 other persons had personal contact with the Son of God. I think that's about as much as we can say about these 500 brethren as to the occasion or as to their own personal identity. But they were witnesses who the majority of were still living at the time that Paul wrote this letter. He said most of them are present. However, a few have already died, but they were well enough known among the churches that Paul could simply say above 500 brethren, and people immediately could understand that he had reference to a certain segment of people who had personally witnessed the resurrected body of the Son of God. And then Peter mentions James. After that, he was seen of James. We do not know which James. There are a number of men whose names were James. However, most people believe that this had reference to James, who's referred to as the brother of Jesus, who was the pastor of the church at Jerusalem. And this would have great weight as far as testimony is concerned, and that is to appeal to the pastoral leadership of the church at Jerusalem, which had become, after the resurrection of Jesus, the church which had scattered abroad, and perhaps some of the people here at Corinth knew James, or in their concourse with the Jewish brethren knew this man. Whoever he was a man whose witness was believable, whose life was one that gave credit to his testimony. Then, of all the apostles, he was seen of the 12, he was seen by these, then of all the apostles. And if you'll read Acts chapter 1, you'll see that this probably is what Paul had in mind. That is the time when the disciples, or the apostles rather, had come, and just before Jesus ascended, there was again a restatement of the commission to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, and then Jesus was taken up out of their sight. Now, Paul doesn't exclude himself as a witness to the resurrected body of the Son of God. Last of all, Paul says, he was seen of me as one born out of due time. Now, Paul says, I am the last apostle to have seen Jesus. He was seen last as an apostle. He was seen by me. You remember that Paul wasn't saved until after the resurrection of the Son of God. He persecuted the church of God, but he was saved after all the other apostles had been active. They had received Jesus through the preaching of John the Baptist. Paul is the last one of the apostles to have seen Jesus. The others had seen him earlier. He's the last one to see Jesus. And the Bible tells us that he saw him as one born out of due season. The word born is from trauma. It has a prefix which means out of. And Paul is saying, I was born out of trauma, which has in it the idea of an untimely birth or an abortion. And I think his statement means this. All of the other apostles lived at the time of John the Baptist, and they believed the preaching of John, and they had John's baptism, and they accompanied with Jesus. They became apostles in a particular fashion. But I became an apostle in a unique and extraordinary way. I believe that's what Paul means. I came later. However, Paul insisted that he was an apostle of Jesus Christ. And he did not feel himself worthy of this. And he states, for I am the least of the apostles. And that simply means the least in magnitude. And he literally means, I am not the last. He doesn't mean that at all. He just means, I am least in magnitude. I don't feel myself to be worthy. And he uses that statement of being called an apostle. He said that I am not meet. The word meet means coming to or reaching to, hence sufficient, competent, or adequate. Paul said, I do not feel. I became an apostle in a very unique fashion. However, I do not feel myself to be qualified to be an apostle. I don't find myself to be qualified or competent to be called an apostle. And then he gives the reason. Because he said, I persecuted the church of God. For this reason, Paul has stated, I belong to the lowest rank of the apostles, and I'm not deserving of the name apostle, for I persecuted the church of God. In other writings, Paul mentions the fact that he witnessed the stoning of Stephen, that he had legal papers that allowed him to go into people's homes and to drag out and put to death those who professed faith in Jesus Christ. Paul calls himself a sinner, that is, above sinners. And I think this is what was on his mind continually, that he persecuted the church of God. And from this, I believe we can learn that a person may be forgiven of the sins that they commit, but forgiveness does not obliterate from one's mind the memory of that sin. Now, Paul knew that God had forgiven him, and he had also experienced the forgiveness of the disciples of the Son of God. At first, they were quite leery of Paul. They didn't want to accept him, but through the witness of other men who had seen a change in Paul's life, Paul was finally accepted as a Christian and as an apostle of the Son of God. And he was forgiven of God, and he was forgiven of other Christians for persecuting the church of God. But this still laid heavy on Paul's heart. And I don't think he ever lost the memory of those he put to death in the name of the Son of God. But Paul said, I have accomplished some things. And later in the letters to the Corinthians, he states, I'm not behind, one whit behind the other apostles. I'm not going to take a back seat to the other apostles in labor, in my work. But by the grace of God, I am what I am. And Paul means by that, had it not been for God's grace, I would not be where I am. And His grace, which was bestowed upon me, was not in vain. The word vain, of course, means empty, and it refers to the contents of something, like an empty vase, some sort of empty container. Paul said then, I am what I am because God bestowed His grace upon me. But God didn't bestow His grace upon me because my life is not empty. My life has produced. I have been active. And Paul has stated in other places that he labored more, or stated the manner in which he labored, the sacrifices that he made and the punishment that he suffered. And here he states, but I labored more abundantly than they all. You know, we see Paul saying, by the grace of God, I am what I am. And we say, oh, here is humility personified. How we appreciate a man who will dish out such a dose of self-depreciation. Sounds so Christ-like to say, by the grace of God, I am what I am. And yet Paul says, but God didn't bestow His grace upon me so that I've been in my lifestyle, in my life, an empty vessel, because I labored more than they all. And evidently he means all the other apostles. He may have been the least, but he considered himself to have produced in labor more than all the other men. And that sort of negates the idea we have that in order for a person to be humble, they have to continually say they're not worth anything. That if a person is able to state in truth, I have done this or done that, it is not against humility. It may be against better judgment, but it's not against humility. Paul said, I labored. The word labor means to be weary in the sense of having literally beat out so much of anything. Like a blacksmith who's beating and beating and beating and beating on a piece of iron to hammer it into a certain fashion until he's just so weary he cannot continue in his labor. And that's what Paul means. I have labored. And it literally means I have exhausted myself. I have driven myself to a point of exhaustion. And the word abundantly means above, the over above. You know, we hear about overachievers today. Well, Paul is saying in this word abundantly, I achieved more than the overachievers. Now, here's what he's saying. The men that I'm referring to, the other apostles, labored abundantly. Yet I more abundantly. He's not saying they didn't do anything. And this word abundantly indicates that. He's saying they overachieved. They labored abundantly, but I overachieved the overachievers. I was more abundant than the abundant workers. He's not saying these men were lazy and they didn't work and they didn't accomplish anything. He's saying that when you look at his life, the life of the other apostles, you'll see that they labored abundantly, but he labored more abundantly. But then he stops and goes back to his original theme. Oh, well, really, it wasn't me. Yet not I, Paul says, but the grace of God which was with me. Yet actually I wasn't doing it, but God worked through me, helping and blessing me. And again, Paul is simply acknowledging the power of God. In these statements, we need to understand that God's grace is all in all. It is by the grace of God that we're saved, plus nothing, minus nothing. But the grace of God, which carries in it the idea of God's protection, God's providence, and in this instance, perhaps more than anything else, the empowering work of Almighty God. God's power is always available to every child of God, but it is available and it empowers us to work to fruition, to bear fruit, to accomplish something. Have you ever noticed that people are always asking for God to assure them and for God to bless them and God to empower them? And I'm sure that God is asking, why? Why do you want me to bless you? Why do you want me to empower you? What will you do with it? God never empowers so we can simply sit and gloat in the power that God will give. And when I hear people talking about how God has empowered them, and yet I do not see a single sacrifice, I don't see a single fruit of their hands or a single fruit of their witness, a single fruit of their testimony, I don't think God has empowered them. They're self-deluded. They think they've been empowered by God, but God doesn't empower people to simply sit. God saves people by His grace, but then His grace, when Paul said, by His grace I am what I am, he simply means by the power of God. I've been able to overachieve above and beyond the overachievers. And this is what I was able to do because I was empowered by the grace of God. There's a good feeling that comes from work. There are a lot of benefits to physical exercise, to getting just honestly, physically tired. There's just one way to get honestly, physically tired and all sweaty and go in and take a good shower and feel the feeling that comes from a lot of physical exercise or from work. You have to pay a price for that, and you know what it is? Work. Whether it's exercise or work or whatever it is, you have to work the body. You can't get you a big banana split and a big gulp, you know, half gallon of Coke, sit down on the couch and put your feet up on a good rest stool and cram all this in you system and sit there and say, now I'll be perspiring for long and I'm going to really get that good feeling that comes from a lot of exercise. You can't do it. And when people say, but I want to feel God's power in my life, then attempt something that requires power. I want to know that God is with me, then go somewhere where you'll recognize His presence. You say, I want to feel God's grace in my life, then do something so significant and out of character with yourself that you will know that the grace of God is upon you. Paul would never have been able to say this if he hadn't done God's will and God's work, because it's all predicated on that. If Paul had just simply gone on to Damascus, become a very complacent church attender, I don't think he could have said, by the grace of God, I am what I am. I don't think anybody would have been able to have said, well, what are you that no one else is? There wasn't that much difference in the lives. There wouldn't have been that much difference in Paul's life and the life of other people. And Paul wasn't saying, by the grace of God, I am what I am, in the sense that I've been saved, but he's saying, I worked and I accomplished and I am what I am as a laborer because of God's grace. You know, in the sense that Paul said here, yet not I, but the grace of God which was with me. We may all claim to be saved by the grace of God, but whether we've had this bestowal of God's grace so that we might labor for Him, that might be questionable as we claim it. Now, Paul's conclusion about the apostles is this, and the eyewitness that all of them had or were involved in as disciples of Jesus was this: therefore, whether it was I or they, so we preach and so you believe. Now, his final statement concerning the apostles and their seeing Jesus and what they'd done, he said, whether I have come and preached or whether they came and preached, what we preached was exactly the same thing, and you people have believed and you've been saved. So it doesn't make any difference if it's the Apostle Paul or the Apostle Peter or the Apostle Thomas, whoever it may be. It is the fact that the apostles preached the same message. I preached Christ crucified, and so did Peter. So whether it was they or I, we preach, and ye believed. Have you ever heard people say, boy, I'll tell you, if we could get someone else, you know, brother so-and-so to preach the gospel, we could have a great revival. You know, I really don't know how I feel about that kind of situation. Somebody said, well, one man can come in and he can preach, nobody's saved, somebody else comes in and he preaches, and a lot of people are saved. And we have to be very careful that such a difference in a response in the preaching the gospel may be more emotion than anything else. Because, see, it's not the preacher, it's the message that counts. You know, I've seen men who would come and they'd preach, and maybe one or two people would be saved. People sort of downhearted and discouraged because there was not this huge stirring. And I've seen other evangelists come in and just scream and cry and holler and tell all sorts of emotional stories. And you'd have a lot of people come down front. Somebody say, boy, that man can really preach the gospel. You have a lot of people added to the church. But it's always been my opinion that people who join on emotion never last long. That's all there is, they never last long. I'm not discounting it. I'm just saying if that's all there is, there's never much to it. So Paul said, somebody's claiming I was saved when Apollos preached because, boy, he could just really get after it. Or somebody said, well, Paul's rather dull in his preaching, or Peter, he's such a fine preacher. The summation, Paul said, is that it's the same, and it's all by the power of God. So no one's better off than someone else in this matter of hearing and being saved.